New York, stick it in your ear.
All right, thanks a lot.
We live in a political world.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York. Coming up next, Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz. This week, an interview that he did with Eric Adams, Brooklyn Borough President and New York City mayoral candidate Eric Adams, during the time when Arthur was running for city council and couldn't do his regular show, which was on Mondays at 5 p.m. He's now moved to Saturdays at noon, and this is an extensive conversation that Arthur had in March with Eric Adams, very telling about Eric's life and also about the candidate's views on policing. Here's Arthur.
We have Eric Adams, the borough president of Brooklyn, with the Brooklyn Bridge walking space behind him. And Eric is running for mayor of the city of New York. Eric and I have spoken before many times, and he was on Advocating for Justice at least once or twice over the years. And he has is agreed to talk to us this morning. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Arthur. And it's really great seeing and speaking with you. You know, I think sometimes people don't realize how long we've been in this battle, you know, and so when you can have conversations like these, it can sort of roll back the clock a little.
Right. It's always interesting to me, you know, I was counsel to Acorn in the first decade of the 2000s, and sometimes you'll give Bertha a call and say, "What's Arthur up to?" So Eric, just you're running for mayor. Just why are you running for mayor? I'm going to make believe to some extent we haven't had some of this conversation before, which we have. But why are you running for mayor?
And you're right, and that's a great question. You know, Arthur, people are saying that competency is on the ballot for 2021, and I say yes to that. But something else is on the ballot, and that's character. You know, who are you as a person? And this run for mayor, believe it or not, is a 24-year journey. It started after going into the police department. I was arrested, as you know, as a child. I was beat bad by police officers. I was a baby. I was 15 years old. And I wanted nothing to do with law enforcement. And it was not until I spoke with and was really recruited by civil rights activists, Reverend Herbert Daughtry and G2A Usi and others, who told 13 of us after Arthur Miller was killed by a chokehold with police. They stated, "It's time for you young men to go into the police department and fight from within." And I was reluctant. I was a computer programmer. I wanted to become Cisco qualified and certified and go and open my own firm. But I went in out of respect. And when I went in, we first was the chair of the Guardians, went on to become the co-founder of 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. And that's the story that many know of our fighting for reform. But you know what's missing from that bio? I was part of a small team of police officers. I was a police officer special assignment. And a man named Jack Maple felt that we can be safe in the city. No more 2,000 homicides a year. No more 98,000 robberies and felonious assaults. Everyone having a no radio sign in their car, having a club on their steering wheel. He said, "Listen, we can use technology to make policing in this country go from being reactive to proactive to predictive." And I was part of the small group of officers that designed that first system called OLTPS in the transit police. Then we came out with another version within the NYPD that became CompStat, and we turned around crime in the city. And I learned from that if we can change the disformity and dysfunctionality of the NYPD and make it function, that we can do it in every agencies in the city, and I went on a 24-year journey after speaking to Bill Lynch on what I need to do to become mayor one day.
So let's go back a little bit. So where were you born? Where you come from?
I was born in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and mom, you know, is an amazing woman. She decided she wanted to move us out of a 4-story rat-infested tenement and move to Queens. That was, and it was thought of at that time. And she did that. She cleaned the houses of people, ironed thousands of pieces of clothing, and finally saved up enough money for a down payment. You know what's interesting, Arthur? She walked into the bank to do her closing. And when she walked in, the attorney who she cleaned his house was there. And he said, "Dorothy, what are you doing here?" She said, "This is my house," in her humble voice. After she did her closing, she went home. She went to his house. She cleaned it. When she finished, he fired her. He says, "How dare you think you're going to buy a house?" And mom went into the train station. She said she cried that day and yelled out as the trains went by. She dried her eyes and she went home and fought to keep that house. And my mom still lives in that house today because of her determination.
So you grew up in Queens. So you began growing up in Brooklyn, and then you grew up in Queens.
Yes, in South Jamaica, Queens, right outside of St. Albans, Queens.
And where'd you go to high school?
Went to Bayside High School. I was bused to Bayside. I went to public school, PS 140, in South Jamaica, Queens, and then IS 8, which is also in South Jamaica, Queens. And then they bused me out to Bayside High School. It was a 2-bus ride every morning to get there in time for classes.
So the story you've told it on my show before, and I know you get to repeat it a lot during the campaign, about getting beat up. How did that come about?
And that's the sadistic part of this. You know, my brother was the first one to get apprehended by the police, but I was second to be apprehended. We were charged with criminal trespassing. It's so funny back then. We were good friends with a go-go dancer who broke her leg, and we were helping her while she was going through her process. I was running numbers at that time, Arthur. I don't know if you remember, numbers were illegal in the city.
Now they call it the lottery. Yeah.
I was a number. I used to pick up the slips for the local number person to help mom pay the mortgage. And we used the money to help her with her broken leg, the go-go dancer. And after she healed, she didn't want to pay us back. And we went to her house. She called the cops. We were arrested for criminal trespassing. And they were just filling out the paper in the 103rd precinct, the precinct where Sean Bell was shot and killed in. And they were just filling out the documents. And out of nowhere, one of them said, "Do you feel like a beatdown?" And they took us downstairs in the 103rd precinct. And they just continued to just kick us in our groins over and over again. And we yelled and screamed, and it seemed like no one in the precinct responded. And that made me feel or believe that this was a norm. This is something that happened often. A black officer stuck his head in the room and said, "That's enough." He left, and they eventually took us back upstairs. And it was just a horrific experience because, remember, I was a 15-year-old child at that time.
So that happened to you, and you know, just I assume it's an interesting thing. So that would have been, you're a little bit younger than me, but that would have been what, in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s?
It was actually 1975 to be exact.
And so even though I just recently wrote an article in a local newspaper in the village about how every time there's been advances for black people in the United States, it's been met by a reaction. The New York Times recently did a story about the draft riots of 1863, which followed right after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And they came out with the draft, and blacks, the newly freed blacks were not eligible to be drafted. And all these white working class people in New York thought that they were going to get drafted because rich white people got to buy their way out, right? The working class whites were going to get drafted, and they thought that the blacks that had just been freed were going to take over their jobs. And there were marauding crowds for a week. They killed almost 1,000 people. They would find black folks walking down the street, chase them, club them, hang them, and burn them. I mean, I discovered like six blocks from where I live, there's a tree where there was a black man, you know, hung and burned in Greenwich Village, right? And at that point, almost all black people left Lower Manhattan because it was not safe for them to live there. You know, so by the 1970s, there were advances in the 60s. And then in the 1970s, we had the blowback with Richard Nixon and, you know, and his movement, the silent majority. And I guess you sort of took it as a given. You weren't running out doing a press conference, accusing the cops, suing the cops when you got beat up. You just took it as that's something you had to endure.
So it's so true. And that's a powerful commentary you just gave, because it's alluded to in that movie, Gangs of New York.
Right.
You know, and that's what put me on that search also. And, you know, really people did not connect what was happening to blacks during that time and what led to a lot of those riots. But Wednesday, I was in the Bronx, Arthur, at Spofford. Spofford was the juvenile detention facility. And I stopped up to see Salamanca. And when I walked down the block, because he did a new redevelopment plan on the Spofford site, and the street Spofford was there, and it sent chills. It almost had my eyes tearing up, because that's where I was housed. And as children, many of us from South Jamaica, Queens, identified with that word Spofford, because we knew that was almost our destiny. And so having police beat you, or knowing that you were going to Spofford, you know, it was just, you know, this was a reality that, you know, many of us, we were going to end there. And so to return to that site, it just brought back so many memories of sitting there that evening when I was dropped off and using the restroom and seeing blood come from inside me as I urinated. It was just, you know, all those memories came back. But that was a reality for a lot of black and brown children in this city.
So did you actually spend time in Spofford? Did you have to serve a sentence?
No, I had to stay overnight until I was transported back to a family court, where I was released to my mom. And my brother went to Central Booking at the time, but I didn't have to serve any time. I was put on probation. I went to my counselor at the time at my first visit. She just detected this level of just anger and bitterness in me. And she didn't realize I was angry and bitter, because I saw this symbol of authority abuse me in a manner that I just didn't think was acceptable. And I remember her telling my brother to come back next week for his visit. And she told me, "Eric, don't even bother coming back," because in her mind, I would never be able to change this anger. But she never understood where that anger came from.
So you got out, and I assume then somehow you decided to become you finished high school and decided to become a cop?
Yes, it was, again, it was a recruitment. I wanted nothing to do with police. Every time I heard a siren, I would relive that beating. Every time I saw that old sitcom, Adam 12, I couldn't even watch it. I would relive it. If I saw a police car drive by, I would relive it. It's amazing how things are hardwired into our mind. And, you know, even in our subconscious, they become part of something we connect with. And it wasn't until we had the shooting of a young man named Randolph Evans. He was shot in the housing police department. Housing police shot him, and the person was found not guilty. And then we had the Arthur Miller issue, that he was a prominent businessman and he was killed by police in a chokehold, that it really invoked a different energy in the Black civil rights movement, and it took us on a new direction. And Reverend Herbert Daughtry had a group of us go into the police department because of that.
So, again, you know, it's interesting talking to somebody who's been around a while. For people listening, who was Herbert Daughtry?
Herbert Daughtry was, I don't want to say he was the Al Sharpton of the day, but he was considered a minister that used the pulpit to mobilize people around issues. And he was an unbelievable, and still is, person. Reverend Daughtry may be close to 90 right now, still moving around as though he's 21 years old. He was the head of an organization called the National Black United Front. I was the youth leader and minister at the youth leader of the young people at that time. And it would just address, the organization address issues of police abuse, issues of economic development, employment, housing, all of these issues that many people believe are new today, but they have been here for some time, and we have had some real warriors fighting for these things. Reverend Daughtry was one of them. He was always often critical of Ed Koch. They would go back and forth over and over again.
You know, and it's interesting. I had an experience with Reverend Daughtry. You know, in the late 2000s, I was general counsel of ACORN, and there was a development going on at Atlantic. I think it was Atlantic Yards, which still may not be built. And that was, and that means it's 13 years ago. But there was a split between the Black community and I'm not sure what the anti-development folks in Brooklyn, because the Reverend Daughtry, together with Bertha Lewis at ACORN, negotiated a deal about jobs going to people from Brooklyn, and there being, you know, a goal, or let's say a quota, I'm not afraid of that word, of Blacks and Hispanics who had to be hired to work on the project, and there was going to be, goals for who was going to get the apartments and affordable, you know, housing, and it wasn't worked out by the government. It was worked out in a private deal, and I remember working with Reverend Daughtry on that. He definitely, and I also remember him going toe to toe with Ed Koch, who, by the way, has a bridge named after him. And I know you've been asked at least one forum by the Jim Alls Liberal Democrats if you became mayor, would you take his name off the bridge? And I think you said yes. So you're working with Reverend Daughtry, and then it was his idea to send kids into the police department.
Yes, he felt that we could not only fight outside. We need to go in and put in place some structured reforms. And it was really forward thinking of Reverend Daughtry, because not only were we able to advocate on behalf of the people of the city during those difficult years of those Giuliani years. Many people don't recall policing under the Giuliani years. But I was also able to recover from the PTSD I was experiencing. Sometimes the best way to get a demon out of you is to go inside. And I really found the demasculation I felt in that precinct when I was assaulted. I found a sense of pride and purpose by standing up and fighting on behalf of people. Organizing around the Amadou Diallo shooting, the Abner Louima sodomizing, the Zongo shooting, fighting against stop and frisk, and challenging a system that really broke me as a child. But I was able to repair that brokenness because of my engagement every day. You know, I was excited to wake up every day and go into battle to reform what policing was like.
So you go into the police department, and what do you, you're what, how old, 20, 19?
I was 24 at the time.
And so what was it like?
extremely challenging. I recall
around 1980-ish.
Yes, 1984 to be exact. And Arthur, think about this for a moment. I'm in the police academy, and Eleanor Bumpus is killed. And I am inside the class, and the instructor is justifying the killing where Sullivan shot her in her chest with a shotgun. And I'm saying, no, that was racist and wrong. And right then, everyone looked at me, the black officers, the small number who were there, they said, you know what, you're making it difficult for all of us, and they're not going to allow you to stay. And that sent a signal to everyone in there that I was a problem person. But I really didn't care at that time because I didn't think I was going to last a year. I said I was going to go in and be as disruptive as possible. And eventually they were going to get rid of me. And it became part of just the legacy of, you know, really pushing back against the racist teaching that was in the police academy all the way throughout the entire training of police officers.
So what did, you know, just an interesting aside, I go to, one of the things you have to do when you're running for city council is you go to your local police precinct community meetings, right? And I've talked to some of the cops and I mentioned your name and it's like, he ain't one of us. You know, there are people that running against you who say, oh, you know, he's really still a cop at heart and he's really soft on the police. And then, but when I talk to the police, it's like, he's not one of us. He was never part of us. You know, he was a troublemaker in the police department. and really the cops do not look at you as like one of their own who they're going to put their arms around, that as far as I could tell, at least white cops. So what did you do in the police department?
And I think that's a great assessment of this place that I am in called law enforcement purgatory. You know, you have so many that are not aware of what those days were like when I was in the police department that they said they don't know who I am and what I went through. So they automatically say, well, you know what, he's the police, so he's always one of them. And then you had those who were in the agency who wanted to perpetuate that level of racism and bigotry and anti-Semitism, anti-gay, anti-black and brown and immigrant, who say he's not one of us. But the us is slowly changing. That whole concept of us is changing because the demographics, you're now seeing more South Asian, more Muslims, or more women, the increase of Spanish-speaking officers. So those numerical minority that held on to the old way of thinking, they're finding themselves having to either cycle out of the department or change. But in the department at that time, during the 80s, mid-80s, first of all, there was no belief that we could keep the city safe. Second, everyone was interpreted to be a low life, a skel, as the term was used. And people were treated like that. One of the best examples, Arthur, was one day I was with a rookie officer and we walked inside a NYCHA development and there was urine in the elevator. And the rookie officer stated, you see, Lieutenant, these people piss in the elevator. They don't deserve anything. This is what they talked about in the academy. And I told the young officer, I said, one person urinated in that elevator. Everyone in this building is as upset as you are about it. But when you start policing people based on everyone in that building urinating in the elevator, then you no longer have respect for all the people. That is how we treat people in black and brown communities, based on the actions of the numerical minority and not based on the action of the overwhelming majority that just want a safe, clean place to raise their families.
You know, an interesting aside on that, I'm working with the NYCHA tenants in my district. And in fact, I just signed up a whole building worth of people to go on rent strike, which someone called me and said, they're not allowed to go on rent strike. And I said, what are they going to do? Kick the whole building out? and they haven't had gas for 5 weeks, and the night you told them that they won't have it for 6 months. Can you imagine living without gas?
Wow.
They can't cook, right? So when I had a meeting with the tenants last week, and they told me the reason there's urine in the hallways is because the doors are broken and homeless people come wandering in and pee. They'll sleep in the hallway and they pee and they do all kinds of shit in the hallway, right? And then someone will come and say, oh, it's the fault of the tenants. They don't keep the place clean. Some of them actually scrub their floors, and they clean and wash and scrub their own floors every week because they have kids and they don't want them walking through the squalor that they don't have any control over.
You're listening to Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz. His guest is Eric Adams, New York City mayoral candidate and Brooklyn Borough President.
So you're in the PD, and then you start organizing, right?
Yes. And the organizational practices were not restricted just to the police department. I started reaching out to those advocates throughout the police department, outside the police department. Some familiar names, the Johnny Cochran's, the Reverend Sharpton's, Bertha Lewis, Elambe Brath, Sonny Carson's, all of these people who wanted nothing to do with the police department. I started communicating with them, and we were able to build this almost underground network where my organization, we were able to really assist in information and how to communicate, because we never really had that level of communications with those who were fighting from within and those who were outside. The law enforcement agencies, they had their people who would communicate and give them information through COINTELPRO programs, through other programs. But we were, for the first time, we had our own underground communication network that we will assist those who were fighting for reform on the outside. And people had a level of trust. They knew me. They knew where I came from, because prior to getting into the department, I was already on the ground, on the street level, part of the same activism, was part of the same marches and pushback. They knew that I was a person that assembled together a group of people that could be trusted, because we handpicked the members of 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement. It wasn't an open organization. 10 people reached out to 10 people they knew that they trusted, and we kept those numbers tight.
So so you create this organization, 100
Blacks in Law Enforcement.
Blacks in Law Enforcement. And what did you guys start doing?
Number one, advocating on what needed to be changed in the police department, because, change is generational, and you have to really learn exactly how do you change the police department. Because it was an institution that was born out of catching slaves and protecting property. And so we had to understand, how do you actually go about implementing change? So we target specific areas like stop and frisk, promotion of people who were conscious and of good means up through the ranks. Because a precinct commander is an extremely powerful position. And if you have a precinct commander that's receptive to the community, that's going to trickle down to their offices. And so we push for diversity in the ranks, and you're starting to see some of that. Chief Madry came up through the whole ranks of our advocacy. Chief Holmes, people who are chief of patrol, chief of department, all of these have come up through that advocacy. Rodney Harris, who's now chief of department, his wife and his mother-in-law were part of our organization. So you're starting to see the benefits of planting those seeds, of diversifying the hierarchy of the police department, came from much of the advocacy that we put in place. And then we wanted to expose the isms that were in the police department and remained silent for a long time. The anti-Semitism, People often talk about the racism in the police department, but the police department institutionally is a very anti-Semitic place. The Islamophobia, we pointed out and talked about and raised consciousness when police departments and our police department was infiltrating mosques and not allowing Muslims to worship in peace. Homophobia, what was happening to the LGBTQ community under the police department was horrific. Targeting gay clubs, gay nightclubs, targeting young gay people in the city. And so we wanted to use our roles as professionals in the agencies to expose, highlight, amplify change, and show people how to go about doing that change. And we did it every day.
So you hit a point, you're active, you're doing all this stuff. What was the reaction of the brass to you?
It was extremely, extremely confrontational, negative. There were a lot of physical altercations between officers of color and other officers. And I want to be clear, we're not saying, and I would never say that all of the white officers in the police department are coming with racist attitude. That is so untrue. There were many white officers in the police department who were outraged over what they were seeing in the police department. The problem was the number of officers who were abusive were able to find a safe haven inside the NYPD and inside law enforcement entities all over this country. And so there was a real backlash. During Giuliani's administration, we later learned that I was under surveillance for a long period of time by the police department, and they kept an eye on me. They were monitoring my phone calls. They were keeping a watch on me. We still don't know to this day. We don't know if it was the police or not, but my car windows were shot out one day when I was off duty after someone called out my name. Everything from dead rats on my locker to other forms of attempts of intimidation took place. Because remember, policing is a close-knit environment where once you have that scarlet letter, it's going to follow you throughout your entire career. But I was extremely successful in the sense of law enforcement, of being promoted through the ranks. I studied hard. I was able to take exams. And I went from being a police officer special assignment to a sergeant, to a lieutenant, and eventually a captain. They attempted not to promote me to captain, but they were compelled to do so because so many people were behind me on the list. And that's where I retired as. But it was 22 turbulent, nonstop years of intimidation and some form of harassment.
So, although I want to talk about what you did after you retired, I just want to talk about the police now, because as you know, it's a big issue in the city. It became, you know, it's interesting as you talk about Eleanor Bumpers and Arthur Mitchell and all Abner Louima and all these names that are like 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And a lot of young activists never heard of those people and sometimes act like the police department just started, you know, police around the country just started killing black people. And it's been an issue in New York City and in the country for decades and decades and decades, right? As you said, the police department went back to catching slaves. The police departments around the country went back to catching slaves, escaped slaves. But the PD has been, you know, is a big issue in New York City. In my article that I recently read, I also talked about how there's a thing about progressive activists or white liberal activists who get angry about racism and march about it, and then it sort of fades, right? The movement sort of fades. So last May, when George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, you know, you had thousands and thousands of people marching all over the city, and those marches kind of faded away, right? And you know, today there's a rally I'm going to go to in Washington Square Park, at 1 o'clock, and it's about tax the rich and Cuomo should resign. But no, but nobody commemorated anything about Breonna Taylor, who was killed a year ago. You know, it's an interesting issue. But the police remain an issue in the mayoral election. And I just moving it forward, like how do you view today's police department? I mean, last spring, there's no question, you know, there was an IG report, and the Attorney General Letitia James put out a report that found that the police department was basically out of control during those marches. You know, little control from the top, little planning, little training, little ability to deal with in confrontations. What do you think needs to be done with the NYPD?
And that's a great question. And here's the problem, Arthur. People like symbolism, and we need substantive changes. And in order to do that, we have to move from the bumper stickers and the slogans. And that is challenging because the bumper stickers and the slogans are more sexy. They're more attractive. It's great to march. I remember during the height of the Black Lives Matter marches and seeing some of my friends on Twitter and Tweet and social media seeing it as, you know, hey, I can't go to the bars and restaurants because they're closed. So, hey, we had a good time meeting up and marching. It became chic for the moment. Real change is not chic. It's not pretty. And if we're going to change the police department, we need to first acknowledge, one, what is the role of the police? Because police, they do have a role in society. And if we acknowledge that, then we should be clear on what their role is and what should our police departments look like. That's real work. That is not just doing a Sunday march. And so, one, we need to change the demographics of our police department. That's why I called and running for mayor, something that's directly within my powers, that all of my peace officers, after 2 years of being a peace officer, we're going to promote them into the police department after they have a great service, excellent service of interaction with people. Those are the hospital police, the traffic enforcement agents, and the HRA police. This way, those individuals are 100% New Yorkers, overwhelmingly Black, Brown, and South Asian. We would diversify the department in a 2-year period. It makes economic sense because we have a middle class New Yorker spend money here, and it makes sense of diversifying department based on the diversity of the city. Second, which I think is crucial that many people don't understand, is, as I indicated, the power of a precinct commander. Community leaders, civic, community boards, block association, bids should interview the precinct commander to see if he or she is a fit for their community. This changes that dynamic instantly. Right now, you don't know where your precinct commander is coming from. You don't know what was his or her past like. They could have been abusive and dropped into your community without you having any review. You now have the 50A law. You can review his past record. You can ask him what is his vision on policing. How's he going to interact with young people? That changes the relationship between the precinct commander and the community that they are going to be in charge of with a 300-person team. You use policing correctly in responding to mental health illnesses by having social service workers there. You use it correctly by helping businesses stay open and not closing them, by really improving the quality of life. You change the dynamic of policing in your community. And those are some of the things we must do. And lastly, we have to rebuild trust by no longer allowing those officers who have a problem and should not be wearing a police uniform, stay on for a long period of time. Once we identify that they're not suitable to do law enforcement, we need to remove them within 60 days after a fair departmental trial. But look at the Pantaleo case. That officer remained in the department for over 4 years. That sends the wrong message. You can't rebuild trust in this way.
What do you think the role of the CCRB should be? And versus disciplinary decisions ultimately coming down to the commissioner?
It should not come down to the commissioner. I think the ultimate decision should come down from the mayor. But public safety is too important to allow this internal mechanism of police commissioners. Because remember, many police commissioners came up through the ranks. They believe in, for the most part, this nice stick justice. And so I don't think we should leave it up to the police commissioner. I think it should be left up to the mayor. Now, many people want to shift that decision to the CCRB. We have to be very careful because fairness is also crucial. We need a fair system of making sure we identify those officers who commit illegal actions, inappropriate actions, or who honestly, due to the job, have made an action that, based on the fast pace of policing, should be retrained, reinstructed, or given some form of discipline that is not calling for the removal of their job. There is no industry in this city where you automatically, based on what was actually would have been written in a article, you're going to determine we're going to get rid of this officer. We must have thorough, fair investigations. And if we're going to turn that over to the CCRB, we must give them subpoena power. We must give them good investigators, because doing investigation is where the facts lay, not where the popularity may be. And because we can never move away from the fair sense of justice. And that is what I want us always to think about. There's a level of discipline that comes with that. And there's a level of just fairness that we must make sure that officers treated fairly and the person who was the victim of any inappropriate action is treated fairly, so we could come to a real determination.
You know, I would, you know, I'm a labor lawyer, but that's what I do every in the daytime. And I represent mostly public employees. And in some agencies, well, in the Transit Authority, which is my main work, I'm counsel to the Transport Workers Union. You know, people get brought up on charges for doing things, and they do appear in front of a neutral arbitrator who the union and management have to agree on. So it's generally not somebody who's like a, you know, get them all or free them all. It's somebody who sort of comes down the middle and has to be fair, or that man or woman is going to get booted off the panel. And, you know, and that person, that arbitrator makes the decision. It isn't the chairman of the MTA or the, you know, or the governor who makes the decision. It's that panel. And I think, you know, as long as the person charged has the resources, which is like their union, to do a thorough defense, and the agency has its resources to, to present the evidence that they found through investigation, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, I'd have to say, after doing this for 40 years, that it, you know, the people that deserve to get fired, and the people that don't deserve to get fired get something else, a suspension, a warning, or vindicated. You know, I recently did a case with a guy who was in a bath. He was a cleaner, a 50-something-year-old guy. It was his second career. He was cleaning, and a white supervisor came in and to the bathroom that he was cleaning and pushed his way past him to go use the toilet. And the guy said, "Can you like let me finish?" He was filling a bucket, right? And the supervisor just grumbled at him and pointed to his hands and said, "I don't know how you can live with yourself." Some racist shit like that. And then he didn't know who the guy was. And he reported it. And the next time they told him, his supervisor said, "Take his picture. If he comes in again, take his picture." So 2 days later, sure enough, the same guy comes in. He's filling a bucket and he starts taking his picture. And the supervisor swatted his phone out of his hand and fell in the toilet. And then when he went to go grab his phone out of the toilet, the guy slugged him. And then he stood up and he punched the supervisor so hard that his teeth came out and there was blood all over the walls. the guy goes running out, and the police come and arrest the black cleaner. And I got to defend him, right? And, you know, the arbitrator was, like, horrified. He was horrified. And he put him back, you know, like, we finished the hearing. He said, okay, I don't even have to write a decision. Put him back to work immediately, you know. So, you know, it was this, it worked, you know, this, it worked, right? We had, you know, a fair system. But let's go back to, I want to go back to, what about this stuff about moving money out of the police department into other agencies, like what they call, some people call it defunding the police. I call it reimagining the police, taking mental health services out of the police department, taking traffic accident enforcement out of the police department, taking other non law enforcement functions out of the police department and moving them elsewhere. How do you feel about those kind of proposals?
That's a real win. Listen, we have to stop doing things the way we have always done them, merely because we've always done them that way. And we are in a place right now where we must reimagine our entire city. And that is what I talk about often on the campaign trail. But you don't do it in a manner that is going to jeopardize public safety. Public safety is the prerequisite to prosperity. We must be safe. So if you look at the police department and all of our agencies, there's too much fat in all of our agencies. We could trim that police budget without hurting public safety. You can drop the manpower of the police department without dropping the patrol strength, because that's the role of police. Police should be protecting us and being on patrol. Not the way we're currently doing it. Too many officers are inside clerical duties. We didn't hire police officers to be telephone switchboard operators. Or to be in the deputy of public information or barrier detail. We need to civilianize those departments, put our officers back to patrol where we need them to be, and then look at what they're doing on patrol. Officers don't have to respond to all of the calls for mental health crises, but we should not have a blanket rule like some are asking, that under no circumstance should an officer ever go to a mental health crisis. That is dangerous to the mental health professionals, the family members, and that person who's going through that crisis. Because if the person on the subway system a few weeks ago, he was going through a mental health crisis and he stabbed four people. If you say a blanket rule that an officer should never respond to incidents like that, you are endangering the lives of people. And you can't say, well, they should respond after the mental health person calls them, because that is just not how law enforcement operates. Law enforcement operates with seconds, not hours. You don't have time sometimes to do this analysis to determine that, am I going to call a person that's trained on restraint? But we can look at these calls of service. When you don't need police, let a mental health professional go. We could decrease those jobs probably by 70%, which is a substantial lot of number of jobs. Officers don't have to go to vehicle accidents. They don't have to go to past crimes reported just to fill out paperwork. So there are many things, even parades. You have witnessed this at parades. You had 8-9 officers just standing around each other chatting. That's all overtime for the most part. We could bring down that $400 million overtime budget, rethink the ecosystem of public safety, use those dollars to be proactive and preventing the conditions that cause crime instead of just being reactionary about crime.
So let's go back to, if you get out of the police department, and I think this is an important thing in this in this race, because there are actually very few people who have as the time and service in government and levels of government that you have. And I'm just going to just paint a quick picture. You leave the PD, you become a state senator, you were a state senator for a period of time, and then you become Brooklyn Borough president. So you've been in the field, you've been in Albany, you've been in Borough Hall. So you were in the state legislature for how long?
For 4 terms.
And and you were a state senator where you were in the minority, meaning not just because you were black, but also because you were a Democrat, right? And except maybe there was like a crazy year where the Democrats were in charge for about 6 seconds, and then a bunch of people turned and allied with the Republicans, and then went to jail. How do you think your Albany experience, what importance does that play to your being a good mayor?
Well, I think that it goes back to why this journey has been a 24-year journey. Bill Lynch knew something when he instructed me of being a master, strategist. He said that, Eric, listen, you have an associate's degree. Go back to school and get your bachelor's. I went back at night and obtained my master's, 2 classes at a time. He says that you need to get promoted to become a lieutenant. I didn't stop at lieutenant. I got even higher, became a captain. But he also said, you need to become a lawmaker in Albany. And I became a state senator. I chaired, and I was the ranking member on crime and correction. I understood the importance of, the laws around crimes. I used to protest as a sergeant with Randy Credico at Rockefeller Plaza to reverse the Rockefeller drug laws. Little did I know I was going to co-sponsor the legislation to overturn those draconian laws. But also, he said, become a congressperson or borough president. I became the borough president. And so when you look at the accumulation of my life, not only what I did in my professional capacity, but to mention those names like Randy Credico, to mention the names of the people who were on the ground.
By the way, Randy and I are very good friends.
Yes. But these are all the names. The other day, Arthur, I was on a panel with Muslim leaders. And I say this over and over again. I'm not a new friend to people. I'm an old friend. I was standing in front of the 3rd Avenue Federal Penitentiary when Muslim young men were being removed from their homes in the middle of the night after 9/11, calling for their release. I met with Muslim mothers in the basement on Coney Island Avenue when their sons were disappearing to organize them on how to move forward. I know which I stood with Chinese family members over 20 years ago when a young Chinese delivery person was assaulted and killed. So I know these narratives because I know the people, and that is the character of the next mayor. I'm not introducing myself to people. These are familiar faces, organizations, and groups. And my days in Albany is preparing me to really do some of the institutional things we need to deal with the dysfunctionality of running our cities.
So Albany is pretty key to running New York City. Because we can't, I think people don't understand, you can talk about taxing this and taxing that, but New York City can't tax anybody unless they get permission from Albany, right? So how do you think your relationship with the people up there, and some of them are still the same people, I mean, you might have to deal with Governor Cuomo next year when you get elected. How are those relationships going to help you in getting New York City what it needs?
I think it helps me extremely well understanding the importance of building building a right relationship, getting everyone on board with the agenda. We are in a good place right now, as you indicated. For the most part, much of my time in Albany, I was in a minority and not in a majority, only 2 years in a majority. Understanding that the overwhelming number of lawmakers that are in power are coming from the New York City area, where we were denied for many years. So I'm not going to be introducing myself to those lawmakers. I know Carl Hastie. I know Andrea Stewart Cousins. I know Janaris. I know, you know, the chairs of these important committees. And I also know how to build the relationships to fight to get our true funding for Campaign for Fiscal Equity, which is important. I know how to identify the right laws that I needed. You know, it was crucial when we wanted to stop the issues around building a database and the stop and frisk movement that Congressman Hakeem Jeffries and I were able to turn that around. So I am clear on how to navigate Albany, but also to build the partnerships. We've created many pieces of legislation together now as the bar president. And so I'm not starting from scratch. I am in a position that I understand every level of our governmental bodies on how to get things done. And I think that's important right now. We can't spend the first 4 years trying to figure out where the bathroom is located in the Capitol. You need to know someone that is very familiar with Albany, that's familiar with these agencies that we're trying to reform, and that's familiar with the communities on what they are asking for.
So you served 8 years and then you become Brooklyn Borough President. Now, a lot of people don't understand what a borough president is, but to me, I was on a community board for 24 years. So I understood the importance of my borough president to what I did on the community board, particularly in the realm of land use. And the borough president plays a critical role, both in appointing community boards and in shaping land use in their borough. What did you learn about where we need to go from being borough president?
So much. Are we talking about on community boards or just overall?
No. Overall, as mayor, what did you learn, you know, from your borough president experience? Because I know we got to wrap up soon. What did you learn from that shapes your how you would approach affordable housing and other land use issues?
Well, number one, Arthur, and I look forward to engaging this some more. But at the foundation of my experience as borough president and this journey is we really need to acknowledge that our city and cities are dysfunctional. And remember, cities are made up of agencies. And if those agencies are not aligned, if they're not operating towards a mission-driven city, then they are going to fight against each other and operate in silos. And that is how we run cities in America. Taxpayers are doing their job. The governments in our cities are not doing their job. And that spills over into our land use process and our development process as well. Eric Adams as mayor, we're going to have a deputy mayor that is going to have in his portfolio every entity that's connected to building housing. We must have an affordable city for low-income and middle-income New Yorkers. So what does that look like? The HRA should go under that deputy mayor. DOB should go under them. NYCHA should go under them. HPD should go under them. Department of Parks should have a interaction with them as well. Why is that important? HPD allocate funding for housing without allocating the right type of housing that HRA is advocating for. So there's a misalignment there. Department of Parks can have a tree in front of a development site and take anywhere from a year or 2 years to remove that tree. And that will hold up the entire project. DOB sometimes don't do their inspections in time and actually can hold up from the architectural drawing approvals to actually getting buildings going. And then we have just the process of how long it takes to get people into affordable housing takes far longer than it takes for someone to get into market rate. We don't align ourselves with the mission and ensure that all the agencies are coordinating with those missions. That's what we learned from the Comstat model of bringing people together that are part of the same mission. And so when you look at development specifically, we have our development wrong. We need to develop in affluent communities upzoning those communities instead of just developing and upzoning in poorer communities, moving affluent New Yorkers in those areas and displacing longtime tenants. We need to move people that are poorer into communities where you have great schools so we can integrate our schools, access to healthy food, transit-rich communities. It's just a different way of thinking about running our city.
I think the story you told, you know, I hope we get it out on the air. I hope you and I can talk some more during the course of this campaign. And if people want to get in touch with your campaign, they go